Today's Taisho is on case 41 in the Umenquan, the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 41 is entitled Bodhidharma's Mind Pacifying. Bodhidharma's Mind Pacifying. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second founder stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." "Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. "I have searched for my mind and I cannot take hold of it," said the second patriarch. "Now your mind is pacified," said Bodhidharma. Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu, came so importantly thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why, Shasanro did not know four ideographs. Mumon's verse, "Coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma and the trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you." Today is the second day of our August Sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for doing a wonderful job this morning. This room was very still, everybody was sitting very deeply, and it was impressive, really impressive. I must say that I sit across from Gary and Yan, and very, very impressive to see people sit for three sits without moving a muscle. And Yan and I have been practicing for many years together now, and of course Yan sits every sit full lotus, and he sits three sits full lotus. It's really intimidating. It makes me pay more attention to my own posture. His posture is always much better than mine. And when I see such good sitting, I'm moved very deeply. It's a great honor to practice with everybody here. Of course, some of you are just here for the first time. And it might not be so surprising that the old veterans can sit for so long, but I'm very impressed also by people here on the first sesshin. You know, three sits in a row is, that's rough, you know. And yet people sitting without moving, three sits, that's very, very impressive. And I want to thank you for your excellent effort. This is just like heaven for me. Just wonderful to practice with people who sit so deeply and practice so open-heartedly. Just a little while ago, we were sitting here, and all of a sudden, the cicadas started singing, and it was awesome, I thought, you know. I wasn't expecting it. I was thinking about Dokusan and who would be coming to Dokusan next, and all of a sudden I thought, what is that? Is that some kind of an electrical device? You know, is there somebody mowing the grass out there with one of those darn weed whackers, you know? And all of a sudden, it's just like this wave starts. wave of sound, and it builds, and it builds, and it builds, and it builds. And there must be thousands of cicadas, there must be thousands or hundreds of them doing this. They must hear each other and just start, you know, building it up and building it up and building it up. And then it's like somebody pulls the energy out and it starts again. It was just breathtaking. I really didn't want to get up, you know. I just wanted to sit there and immerse myself in this beautiful, really like a beautiful. I have been to a number of places that are quite beautiful. I've been to in the Olympic Mountains, and I've been to Mexico, and they have a canyon in Mexico that's like the Grand Canyon, only it's tropical, so that there are orchids growing off the side of the mountain. So wild orchids in the Grand Canyon, right, and palm trees, and it's a trip. Beautiful, you know. And I've been last year. I finally got to Hawaii, which I'd never been to. But I just think that was just as beautiful as the Olympic Mountains, or that was just incredibly beautiful. And who knows, you know, you might remember that moment all your life. And yet, you know, all over New Jersey, this is going on, and who's paying attention? You know, who's paying attention? Hardly anyone. Isn't that amazing? The other night we came out of the Zendo, out of the university room where we sit, and it was a full moon over the horizon, and it was sort of pumpkin colored. It was breathtaking, right? And again, you think, I wonder who noticed, you know? People are in their houses watching the tube or on the internet, and even if they aren't immersed in these artificial worlds that we've created, often people are so distracted that they're oblivious. You know, if you heard those insects, if you heard the cicadas calling, and you know, that's really good. That's a good, you're really in the moment. It's possible that on your first sesshin, first day of your first sesshin, you might not have heard them, you know, really. Because you know, some people come to sesshin and they're so distracted. They're so immersed in these inner debates and inner dramas that the moment is almost invisible to them. And this is how actually many people live their lives, right? I mean, just caught in this, you know, people are like in a kind of trance state. And they're just absolutely, utterly caught up in these ideas and voices that they're speaking with. Some people, voices of the dead sometimes, people long dead that they're still arguing with in their minds, you know. And this is how many people live their lives. I've talked about this before, but you know, one day I was walking down the street in Seattle, and it was a glorious day. It was a sunny day in Seattle. It rains 300 days a year, so basically a sunny day is in itself, you know, quite special. And it was like a cloudless day. And in Seattle, on a cloudless day, you suddenly notice that the city is surrounded by mountains, which are normally invisible. And it's like somebody draws back a magic curtain, and you suddenly realize that Seattle's on a flattened mountaintop, surrounded by mountains. And for about 320 days a year, maybe even more, you never see them. But on this day, the wind had blown away all the clouds, and you looked and you could see Mount Rainier towering in the distance. And anyway, I was going to work, and of course I had gotten up in the morning and gone to sit at the Zen Center. And I was on my way to teach my class, and I ran into my friend, Virginia Chappell. And she was a graduate student in English. And I said, "Virginia, how are you doing?" She said, "Oh, terrible, terrible." And I said, "Well, what's wrong?" And she had just come out of a class where they were discussing a poem by a great poet, William Butler Yeats. And the poem is called The Second Coming. And it's about civilization going to pieces. And it basically says, a monster is on the way to destroy us. That's sort of how the poem ends. And basically the poem says something like, the world is getting worse and worse. People are getting more violent and brutal. And we're entering a new era of brutality. And a monster is coming to destroy us. And we don't know his name yet, but he's on the way. And she was agonizing over this poem. And it fit with other things that were going on in her life and other things that were going on in our society. Basically, she was a very sensitive person, and she was sort of caught in the spell of this poem. And so, she was walking down the street in this horrible funk, in a horrible state of unhappiness. And I said, "But Virginia," she said, "Oh, terrible." She said, "Everything is going to hell. You know, it's all going to hell. It's coming crashing down." And of course, I looked up and, beautiful sky, beautiful. And I said, "Virginia, look, look at this day." And she sort of did shake herself a little bit. And I said, there's not any, no monsters coming right now, It's just a beautiful day. That is so, I just always remember that moment because, of course, I've been on the other side of that too, I mean, I've been so lost in thought and so torn apart by fears and, It's like being possessed. It's like demonic possession, I mean, Yeats is a great poet, and I'm glad he wrote his poem, but it kind of possessed her, right? It sort of occupied her consciousness, and it was a poem is a work of fiction. It's not real. There isn't really a monster coming to get us. It's asking you to play a game and imagine, but it becomes so gripping, it becomes real, And she couldn't break out of it. And I think this happens to all people, all the time. Recently, Russia invaded Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, not the southern state. Georgia has been, doing pretty well. And people are, I think, have been pretty happy there. And Russia has had a disagreement with Georgia over some provinces of Georgia. And so I'm sure you followed this. Georgia was invaded by a Russian army. And it's one of those things you just have to think, why, people make themselves so, not only themselves, but make others so unhappy, just so incredibly unhappy. And people were killed, thousands of people maybe are dead. And you think, what is this all about? What's this all, why? And one way to put it is it's all about the imaginary dignity of an imaginary country filled with an imaginary people called the Russians. Yeah. And by the way, you know, I love Tolstoy and I love Russian literature, so, but you know, actually, there isn't any such thing as a Russian. There's not. There's not such a thing as an American. Those are like imaginary constructs. Those are imaginary. You learn, you know, when you were born, you weren't born an American. You weren't. That's ridiculous, you know. You know, the sky isn't American, you know. It's not, you know. The clouds aren't American. You know, those are, I've actually had people say that to me, you know. Those are American mountains. It's like, you've got to be crazy. Right? That's truly like mental illness. The Rocky Mountains aren't American mountains. You know, they were there before anybody ever dreamed of America. And I hate to say it, they'll be there long after we're gone, after America's a footnote, you know. So it's crazy to think that way. But we create these, so we tell these stories about how things are, right? And so, you know, really, the Russians are actually a conglomeration of many different people who all got together over history, and they all call themselves Russians. And like anybody else, you know, there are very tall Russians, and there are very short Russians. And there are Russians who have blonde hair and blue eyes, and there are Russians who have black hair and black eyes, you know, dark eyes. So, you know, but they all think, I'm a Russian, I'm a real Russian. You know, and everybody, you know, Americans do this too. I'm not knocking the Russians, you know. But, you know, really, I mean, Russia has every reason to be happy. You know, they're sitting on one of the biggest, they have about 120 million people on an area that's, I don't know, it's like an eighth of the earth or something. They've got oil, they've got gold, you know, they've got tundras, you know, they've got Siberian tigers, you know. I mean, you know, China has 1.3 billion people, you know, in a much smaller landmass. The Russians are sitting, they have so much land they don't know what to do, you know. Why are they so unhappy? You know, it's because they don't feel respected, right? They feel like they've been dissed, you know, in former glory. Now, you know, America is no different, you know. I mean, we behave exactly the same way, you know, absurdly so. I mean, during the coming election, it's going to be a depressing spectacle, right? To hear everybody invoking the glories of the United States, the American people, you know, we're so great, we don't ever make any mistakes, we're the best, we're the wisest, you know, we're pushed around by others, and, you know, we need to regain our pride, you know, we can't leave Iraq, because that would be backing down. We're not going to cut and run. You know, this is all pride, right? But it's not just pride. We create these imaginary worlds. You know, we create these imaginary worlds, and then we cling desperately to them. But then people start getting killed, right? People start getting killed. And it's ridiculous, right? I mean, there's a wonderful poem about World War I, and this British poet was in the trenches. In World War I, the Germans and the British were at war, and basically they fought from trenches in the ground. So one side had dug a trench like 300 yards away from the other side, and the Germans were in this trench and the British were in this trench. And the Germans and the British are actually like, even though they see themselves as very different, they're actually almost identical. I mean, they're actually physically impossible to tell apart. Their languages are only slightly different. They both come from the same part of the world. They both migrated into, you know, so they're really like the same people, but they have a whole mythology about themselves that makes them see each other as very different. And they were shooting each other and brutalizing each other in the most horrible ways. And this poet wrote this little poem, and he said, you know, I'm shooting this guy. Under other circumstances, I'd probably say, hey, you know, mate, let's go get a beer, you know? And right now, I'm killing him. And of course, you know, people read that poem and they go, tisk, tisk, isn't that a shame, you know? Or they say, that's very moving, but it's very hard for us to escape from these imaginary worlds, which people work so hard to create. I mean, who benefits from convincing everybody that they're Russian? Well, some people, maybe all Russians benefit a little bit. At least they know, you know, what to call themselves. At least they know, who's going to give them orders and so on. But some people benefit enormously from convincing others that they're Russian. You know, some people benefit enormously from convincing you you're an American, and you might benefit much less, you know. Well, the point is that these are dreams. I think they're fantasies, and I think they become dangerous when people start dying unnecessarily. And it happens all the time in history. The most absurd triggers produce this violence. Well, this happens to us as human beings too. You know, it could be a beautiful day. Beautiful day. Sun, low humidity, which is like a miracle for New Jersey, you know, at this time of year. A beautiful insect singing. And right now somebody is abjectly miserable. Maybe not in this room, but, you know, if you walk down the street, you wouldn't have to walk very far to find somebody who's totally unhappy right now. And the chances are it's over something that's not that important. You know, if you met, you know, I mean, I meet unhappy people all the time in my line of work. They come in to see me, you know, and they come in because they're unhappy with their grade, you know. And they got a B+ instead of an A, and they can't sleep. You know, they can't sleep. It's such an injustice. It's like, this cries out to heaven. This is such an injustice. And they'll come in to see me, and the parents will call me. And they'll threaten to get a lawyer, you know. I have rules. I have to follow. I think it's not fair to go, okay, you're pressuring me, I'll change the grade, you know. So I do, you know, rules are imaginary too, but I believe that it would be a good idea if everybody were treated the same. Probably we'd agree that that's a better way to go. So, you know, I'll read the papers. We have a committee that reads these papers, and if they feel there's an injustice, they're told to correct the grade. But, you know, most people don't get a change of grade, and they're furious, you know. This happens all the time, right? You don't have to go far to meet people who are abjectly miserable, and you don't have to go far to meet people who, if they were in this room right now, wouldn't even notice the song of the katydids, the song of the cicadas. They'd be so wrapped up in their minds, you know. They're just these, and it's people are like haunted. I mean, people are like haunted by their troubles, by their fantasies, and I have a friend, a good friend of mine, Richard is his name. His father tried to kill himself on several different occasions. Richard Miller is the chairman of the English department, and he has actually written about his father's suicide attempts, but they weren't pretend. His father really tried to kill himself. And his father was wanted to be a novelist. He was a writer, and he published a number of things, but he never got critical recognition. And as he got older, instead of getting more and more respected and well-known, he became more and more obscure. And so he would dutifully go in and work on his writing and try to publish these things. And he couldn't get a lot of it published, and he got more and more depressed, and he became like a manic depressive personality after a while, and tried to kill himself twice. And of course, as you can imagine, you know, seeing your dad try to kill himself makes quite an impression. And so Richard, you know, I know that sometimes I can see his face. You know, he's a good friend of mine. I can see that there, you know, sometimes things remind him of this, you know, or, you know, and I'm sure he, or I know he struggles with this, you know, because he's sort of carrying the ghosts of his father with him, you know. And I myself have carried ghosts with me all my life. We all carry them, right? My father was very, very strict person. And he had a drinking problem because he could not forgive himself for not being successful in his line of work. And he was a true alcoholic, and he really hated himself for not being more successful. And he conveyed to his children the importance of being a winner, not a loser, you know. So he would say, you've got to be a winner, don't be a loser, you know. And he would be sometimes very drunk when he was giving me these lessons, you know. I could never do enough to please my father, you know. I mean, this is so common, right? I mean, and I remember once coming home with all A's and one B plus. And I came home and I showed it to my dad, and he said, "That's good, but what's wrong with this B plus? You know, really?" I mean, you would think he would have gone, "Oh, you're doing a wonderful job. You know, this is so good, right?" He says, "Well, wait a minute. Why didn't you get an A on this?" You know, and really, that was who, you know, when I got my job at Rutgers, I was so happy to get a job, because in English, if you have a PhD in English, you know, you have quite a choice of careers awaiting you, you know. You can work in a restaurant, you can, but only a small percentage of people with PhDs in English actually get a job teaching in English, because there's so few jobs. So I went out on the job market, and the first year out, I went to interviews and didn't get any job. And the second year out, I finally got this job at Rutgers, and it was a real long shot, you know. I was amazed I got the job, and when I came to New Jersey, I was unpacking my stuff, and my father called, and he said, "I hear from your brother that you got a job at Rutgers." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "That's pretty good." But he said, "I'm waiting for you to get a job at that place down the street." He meant Princeton. Right? So it was like, this is called snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, you know? You know? So, oh, I was not good enough, I see. And by the way, I mean, I knew my father pretty well by then. But, you know, I carried those ghosts for a long time with me, you know. It takes a lot of zazen to get free from all that. So we may or may not be haunted by the voices of our parents, you know. And maybe they, you know, they make us very stern judges of ourselves sometimes, so much that we hate ourselves. But other voices possess us, you know, and we're trying to please a host of other people and coming up short, you know. And so for all kinds of reasons, we can be abjectly miserable in our lives. And indeed, even people who are not abjectly miserable are often chasing fantasies, you know, chasing them. And people will sometimes do anything to realize their dream. You know, if you think about it, the oil industry is just bad for the whole world, you know. Basically, you know, it's a polluting substance, and you know, it's really very bad for everybody. And yet, for 20 years, people have been fighting a legislation that would improve the gas mileage of automobiles, you know. And you must think, well, you know, why are they doing this? You know, why are they fighting something so hard, which would be so good for people? And we could say, well, they're evil people. But I don't think that quite does justice to it. I think that they have powerful dreams that they're dying to fulfill. And I think they kind of lie to themselves. They kind of, you know, they keep pushing, as the evidence builds up, they keep pushing it away and pushing it away. They don't want to see what threatens their dreams because, you know, realizing those dreams is so important that literally they might, you know, like sacrifice the world for their dreams. And I think this happens all the time. So anyway, you know, Zen is about trying to liberate ourselves from those dreams and those ghosts and trying to live a different way. You know, trying to be free from those compulsive voices. And when we sit on the cushion day one, it's very difficult to be free. You know, as you sit there on the cushion, you're replaying and replaying and replaying. And you're worried about this and you're worried about that, and then, you know, by day two, you know, all of those voices become less oppressive and ever-present. And maybe just a little bit, it becomes possible to be in the moment. You know, if you're watching the breath and you're watching the breath and you're watching the breath, sooner or later your mind starts lingering in the moment. And just a little bit, you're going to notice that there's a kind of stillness to your awareness. It's like the thoughts are fewer and you're spending more time in the pure presence of the moment. And this may have no emotional character at all right now, or it may feel very wonderful. Sometimes for people it can feel really deeply liberating, you know. But either way, this is a real achievement, I think. You know, just being in the moment is so hard for humans. And I think it's so healthy, so good for us. It's so liberating and so healing just to be able to say, this is what's happening right now. Right now, you know, we're sitting on a mat in a room listening to the insects, you know, and feeling the cool breeze on your face and so on and so on. You know, not haunted, not possessed and driven by this storm of thinking, this storm of fantasy. You know, it's cool and refreshing, in my opinion. And maybe you haven't quite had that experience yet, but you've had little glimpses of it. And eventually, it's going to be possible to spend some time, if you work very hard, in the moment. And that's sort of what Zen is all about. That's like the beginning of Zen practice, is being able to stay in the moment long enough to see what is the case and what isn't the case, what's not the case. When the thought machine stops and you can rest in the moment, you are a different kind of being. Really, it may not feel like much, but just keep coming back there. Humans who can do this are very rare, and it's a very different kind of consciousness. If you spend a lot of time there, it will deeply transform you, in my opinion. Eventually, you'll be a very different person. But let me just say that Zen is, you know, Zen practice doesn't stop there. That's really the beginning. You know, what happens is that we're so caught up in fantasy, we're so caught up in dream, that it's really, we have very false images of what the world is like, you know. We're just really just compulsively driven by these illusions. And being in the real, being in the moment, is really so liberating. But then we realize, you know, I don't really know much about the moment. I don't really know much about the world. All I've known is my dreams and my imagination about the world. So Zen is like about rediscovering the world with this new, in this new way. It's like encountering the world not through our dreams and our projections and fears, but the world as it is in itself, you know, and we're part of that world. So when you're suddenly sitting here and you don't have a lot of thoughts in your mind and you're listening to the rise and fall of the insects, this might seem trivial or it might seem beautiful, but it's a real achievement. You know, very few people in New Jersey right now are actually experiencing the moment with this kind of fullness and richness. And it's a vast new world. And Zen is about exploring it. So entering into this state is very precious. Please, you might not realize how precious it is unless you think about how different ordinary reality really is. Most people are driven by these compulsions. They're so, you know, people come into the Zendo and some people never are able to be in the moment, even for a split second. They're just so wrapped up. So day two of Sesshin, sitting here listening to the bugs singing, is just like heaven. This is like, that's so liberating. And then we're going to explore reality in its many, many facets, you know. And the world is not the way we imagine, as a matter of fact. So in Zen we have what's called koan training, koan practice. Now, you know, just because you can enter this state of thoughtlessness and be in the moment right now, doesn't mean you can now turn and explore everything else in the world, because when you get off the cushion, you leave Sesshin, you go home, and you know, things arise, and you still have your fears, you still have the ghosts, and they've been away for an hour or two. They'll be back. And so we keep sweeping away the ghosts, you know, and koans are like helping you to sweep away the ghosts, the fantasies, the compulsions, long enough to explore some other aspect of reality. And we just keep doing this, right? Oh, a little bit, sweep away the ghosts, encounter reality. Sweep away the ghosts, encounter reality. Over and over and over again. And little by little, you begin to get a very different picture of what life is like. Little by little, the world becomes a different place. You know, it's right now it's just a beautiful morning listening to the insects. But, you know, if you add that to some, over, say, 10 years, to many other moments, you're a very different person, and it's a very different kind of world. And the koans are helping you to do that. Koans are a little bit special because they work in an unusual way. Rather than just say, please notice this, please go notice something in the moment. If I said to you, please tell me, tell me about the self. Say, please tell me about yourself. Tell me about the self. If you sit down and say, okay, well, who am I anyway? What is the self? You know, and you just start thinking. very unlikely to break free into the moment. You're just going to be caught in a web of language and conventional ideas and so on. Basically, Zen is trying to break you free from those ghosts, from all those conventional ways of thinking. And the way it does this is to help you to enter the moment. It also uses unconscious cues, like subconscious cues. So a koan is, a famous koan is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? So now this makes very little sense to your discriminating intellect, but it's an unconscious cue. It's giving you a subliminal signal, you could say. And it's helping you to cut through illusion speaking to you on a deeper level, speaking to you on the level of like a deeper unconscious mind. We all have unconscious cues, even if we don't aren't aware of it. You know, I was reading about an article the other day about a woman who is working with chimpanzees and language. She's trying to teach chimpanzees language so that they can have our dreams, right? I don't know if that's a good project or not. She hasn't met with much success, you know. But she had a little party for all the chimps, you know. She wanted the chimps to be like us, so she had a party and she had a table with all the foods that chimps like to eat. They were having a little party and she made a mistake. She said she was in front of one of her chimps and she pulled out some mustard and squeezed some mustard on something they were eating. I don't know if it was a hot dog or not. But the chimp saw the mustard and immediately evacuated its bowels, right? So this is like an unconscious cue, right? And she said, oops, you know, I should have thought of that, you know? You know, when we're little kids, you look at mustard and think, why, that looks like poo-poo, right? And your parents go, no, that's not poo-poo. That goes on a hot dog. Poo-poo doesn't go on a hot dog. I still think it looks like poo-poo, you know. You see, there is this deeper mind, right? The little kid grasps immediately the intuitive connection, right? And there's a deep connection, right? And a chimp grasped it too. Oh, time to go to the bathroom. But we think, well, we're not chimps, you know, but going not so fast. You know? I don't know if you've noticed, but I noticed the other day I have these hairs growing out of my ear like a chimp. You know? I have kind of chimp's ears anyway, but I was in the mirror and I noticed, my God, all these hairs are coming. I look just like an old monkey, you know. So we're not that far away from chimps, you know. But cues, these koans have like a subliminal cue. And of course, it takes some time for the subliminal cue to break through all of the shell of culture and conditioning. Somebody came into the Dokusan room the other day and said, you know, I don't think I have the answer to my koan, but here, let me tell you. In fact, the person kind of said, you know, I've kind of given up on this koan. Here's what's occurring to me right now. And it was like, bing, bing, you know, perfect. What? You know, I said, yeah, I think the person thought I was kidding. You know, that's perfect. Those are correct. But I wasn't trying, he said. You know, I was just doing this sort of half-heartedly, you know. That's not the right word, but sort of, I wasn't really trying. You know, I wasn't really focused. That was right on the money, you know. That's the power of the subliminal cue, you know. Sometimes though, we keep trying to control it or think it through, right? But you know, little by little, if you keep going back to the moment and you keep pushing aside the ghosts, you know, you'll notice something in the koan. The subliminal cue will help you to see something that you're not seeing at first. Now, if that is making some sense. So, this path of Zen is really quite special. It's very difficult for human beings to encounter the real. Almost impossible. But fortunately, not impossible. And when we, the minute you start thinking, if you know, you're on the road to, you have to think, it's true. Thinking has its place. But modern people are driven insane by their thinking. Just literally cannot free themselves, you know. And I think made profoundly unhappy, you know, by their dreams and so on. So being able to break free from that is, you know, the minute you start, if you're unhappy and you're having some release here at Sesshin, you know, the minute you start your thinking machine up again, you're back, you're going to be unhappy again. And you aren't going to be able to think your way out of some kinds of problems. You have to let them go for now. And very often a solution will present itself intuitively. That's true. You know, sometimes you just know what to do. But you need to have a kind of a clarity, kind of breathing room. So please give yourself a little vacation from your unhappiness and confusion. Be in the moment, and probably if you stay there long enough, you'll know what to do. Or you'll know what to say, you know. Bodhidharma sat facing a wall. He's doing meditation, and he's from India, and a man from China, who is a great scholar. He had studied all the Confucian classics and the Taoist literature, but he was still quite unhappy, and couldn't break free from the ghosts and the illusions that humans create. And very unhappy. So he found Bodhidharma sitting in a cave, and he wanted Bodhidharma to teach him, but Bodhidharma said, no, I don't want to teach you, I'm sorry. So finally he cut his arm off and handed it to Bodhidharma to show he was serious. This is a story, please don't do this. and when Bodhidharma said, okay, I'll listen to what you have to say, the guy said, my mind is on fire. I'm so unhappy. Yeah. So unhappy. My mind is on fire. And Bodhidharma says, well, what is your mind anyway? Please sit down on this cushion and watch your mental events and tell me, what is your mind? Where is your mind? So the second founder, so-called, you know, looks in his mind, and there's nothing there. You know, it's like, in my soul, I'm so troubled. I'm so miserable. And Bodhidharma says, well, where is your soul anyway? Find it. You know, I've looked everywhere. I can't even find my soul. So, you know, how do you feel now? Well, a little better. You know, I was so worried about this thing called my soul. Now I realize I can't even find it. Good. Glad. I hope you're feeling a little better. Indeed, feeling a little better. Right. So it was just a fantasy. Just a fantasy. I'm so worried about the United States. You know, so worried. And then you sit down in your cushion and go, there is no such thing as the United States. I feel better already. You can say, oh, that's so bad, you're neglecting your country. Well, that's a subject for another koan, right? What do we owe our country? So in Zen, we don't give answers. We say, let's look at that's the next question. So back to the cushion. How much do I owe my country? I'll make that my koan, and enter deep samadhi, stay in the moment, and if I free myself from ghosts, maybe I'll know the proper answer. You know, but at least I'll be in touch with reality and not caught up in fantasy. So please don't worry about the United States. Just worry about your koan. Watch your breath. Be one with Mu. And when you find yourself in the moment, without too many thoughts, give yourself a little pat on the back. That's basic sanity. It's like welcome home. Welcome home.